Thanks for clicking over to this extra from Speakers Forum, KUOW 94.9 Seattle. I'm your host, John O'Brien. As a backdrop to this piece, every year our Speakers Forum team gathers audio from Lit Crawl Seattle. The organizers call it One Beautiful and Awesomely Weird Night. That really sums it up nicely. It's a festive, roving, inspiring one-night literary festival in and around Seattle. The breadth of great Lit Crawl events is astounding, but this piece by Seattle writer Sonia Lee was pretty stunning. Lee is a screenwriter and essayist. She teaches writing at Seattle's Hugo House. The focus of this piece is her new memoir, Wondering Who You Are. This recording took place on October 22nd, 2015, at the Elliott Bay Book Company. Thank you to Tin House, Elliott Bay, and Lit Crawl Seattle for hosting this event. And thanks to Anna Tatashev for our recording. Please be advised, the following piece contains themes and language of an adult nature. It has not been edited for language.
My husband had a rare cancer, and he went into surgery for this kind of radical treatment at the time. And during the surgery, he lost the equivalent of 3 pitchers full of blood. And when that happens in the body, it depletes oxygen to the brain. And what he suffered that night when I was with him was something called an anoxic insult. It's a form of acquired brain injury. So when he came out, he didn't have the same look on his face that I had grown to know. He had a flat affect, which in the brain injured means that your eyes are shocked wide open and unblinking. His personality had radically changed, which was apparent very quickly. And then he began to talk with me about not having any memories of who he was and how he got there and all of those kinds of things. So we lived there in the cancer center for a month, and after we came home, we started to realize the extent to which his brain had been damaged, and that he had what the neuropsychologists call a permanent disability. But really, it's a complete identity change. It was a complete personality change, and he also lost his language, so he lost the ability to speak and had to reform that. It's been a great experience to be out talking to people on the road. I want to say that first, because I come across a lot of people. Hospitals would send people from trauma centers, and soldiers would come who have had brain injuries. I just ended up having a chance to speak with so many people who had memory and brain injury issues. But I think one of my favorite experiences that I want to talk about was with a woman whose husband wrote a book about his brain injury, and it had a theater piece made out of it. And so she got a chance to see herself enacted on the stage by an actor who was playing the role of the caregiver. And I asked her what the effect of that was on her life, what she got to witness on the stage. And she said, "I got to see the funeral for myself." And I think that was one of the most potent pieces that I heard reflected back to me about this kind of role in a relationship, which is that you lose the other person because their identity has changed. You lose the relationship, and then you also lose a part of yourself. And it is as if an avalanche falls off the mountain. It just kind of ka-chunks down. And I feel like the process of writing the book was a way for me to understand what happened. The piece I want to read to you tonight is a piece that I haven't read in public before. And it's about a part of his memory that he lost that was unpredictable, and that we heard from doctors later that no one had actually, that we came across anyway, had ever heard of someone losing their sexual history. But Richard did, and when he came out, he was as if he was a virgin again. So this is called Heat. When we were teenagers, he was the one who awakened my sexuality. Now we are middle-aged, and I have been given his virginity. It's as if 30 years of sexual exploration have been wiped clean. Long after the brain injury, when I'm sure he has forgotten all that transpired in those early erotic days, he dredges up his first memory of pleasing me. "I remember that look you gave me the first time," he says, soon after we move back to Seattle. We're nestled in our bed in an alcove with a window angled above us. We watch the birds momentarily come into view as clouds swirl past the rectangle. "You do?" I say. When I asked if I could explore, "Everywhere. Oh, my God. You remember?" "You said please," he says, like he's won the jackpot. In my mind, I see the way that I looked at him then, keen, ardent, craving. "Why did you remember that now?" I ask. "It was the sweetest thing I ever heard," he answers. I am not erased. I realize I could respond with irony, some joke about Richard not usually remembering things sweet or sad, yesterday or forever ago. I have become accustomed to his memories that come and go, memories that aren't ensnared in a belief. I don't want to hold on to the romance of his words, words so very few these days, words that are pure and true, words based on a fleeting memory. There's a part of me that wishes to defend my heart, to make sure I don't allow this small miracle to open me. But that woman of dry wit and caustic mockery died en route from the cancer hospital. In that moment, even though he has mostly forgotten our sexual history, I decide I can risk wanting him as a complex, intimate partner. I want a companion who relishes play, a lecherous husband who strips off social correctness like underthings to be cast off. Our sex was once a creative commons, a place for libre learning, freewheeling, edupunk, DIY, no rights reserved action. It doesn't matter that we're not that couple anymore. In the here and now, there's innocence and impartiality and spaciousness and silence and emptiness. On one of our first Saturdays in our new home, Richard eats cereal at the table and looks out the window, which overlooks giant evergreens. "Do you like me?" he says. "You're a late start on Monday and Wednesday, right?" I say, not looking up from the calendar on the computer. He pours himself another bowl of Raisin Bran. "If you eat like you're 20, your body is going to show it," I snark. He chews, keeps looking at me. "I like how you go after what you want," he says. "Even when I hurt you?" "Yeah, I like everything about you," he says. "No, you don't." "I do." "My need to control, the insane obsessions?" He nods. "The freak who yells at a man with a brain injury because he forgot something? Especially her." "Why?" "You're not giving up on me," he says. His honesty makes me breathe as if I've been living on half air. "I'm trying to get to know you," I say. "Me too. I'm trying to get to know me. Do you mean you can't remember?" "That guy," he says, with a nod backward. "The man I want you to be," I say, in a near whisper. For some reason, it hadn't occurred to me that Richard would have to develop a relationship with the one he was before in order to begin enacting that man. For the first time, I wonder what he'd be like if I never asked him to become that man again. And then the thought is so terrifying in its essential emptiness that I push it away, where it will stay sequestered for years. "I was a good lover once," he says. "More than once. Teach me." The first time we told the story of forgetting sex to a neurologist, he said he'd never heard of such a thing. "Does the equipment work?" the doctor said. We nodded. "Well, you'll figure it out then." We'd been happily libidinous through our entire marriage and rarely skipped sex, with short breaks after the births of our children and when we traveled apart. Unlike so many couples we knew, we'd stayed adventurous, made sex a priority, and challenged each other to move out of our comfort zones. But also, sex had been a way of relating to each other when we really hadn't understood each other intellectually or emotionally. Sex had kept us together. Years ago, in therapy, we'd learned new strategies for connecting through conflict. We had since become, in marital strategist John Gottman's parlance, masters at repairing our relationship, moving quickly through discord to forgiveness. Sex was a way of celebrating our fondness and admiration for each other. We stopped holding resentments. We became motivated to please one another. We were, as sex columnist Dan Savage says, good, giving, and game. After our early marital conflicts, we'd become close again, and we found new ways to turn on, explore, indulge, conduct postcodums, fantasize, fetishize, freakify, relish, practice, appreciate. We made concessions for each other's sexual wishes and found ourselves enjoying aspects of ourselves that were beyond our familial and cultural understanding. Before cancer arrived, we hit our groove. We were kids who discovered the delicious treats at the adult candy store. Finding out that some ruthless god had hit the reset button on my husband's sexual history was a cruel joke. I haven't shared my despair over what I've lost with Richard because I'm worried that my grief will harm him. I cry on daily walks. I talk to my therapist friend. I've asked Dr. L what he thinks about Richard losing his sexual history. Memories tied to primitive areas of the brain, such as sexuality, can be selectively damaged, Dr. L said. When I've risked telling a few women friends, they tended to react nonchalantly. They laugh. That's like riding a bike, right? Or, so did you tell him how much he just loved tipping the velvet? The men I've told have mostly been stunned. I'm not laughing. I'm not standing around waiting. I'm going to become a one-woman sex education crash course or die trying. What do you want to try first, he asks, all innocence and excitement. Field trip, I say. Where? Babeland. We go to Seattle's egalitarian erotic emporium, the same place I took my daughter when she wanted to buy her first sex toy. I watch him wade wide-eyed through dildos, double dildos, vibrators, cock rings, condoms, lubricants, handcuffs, collars, blindfolds, harnesses, slings, ropes, strap-ons, edible body paint, massage oil, sex games, instructional books, porn movies, and the orgasm in a box. We scoop up toys to take home. Sexual exploration becomes like summer vacation. There are few rules. The children are in college. We stay up late, playing. At first, I think the teenage sex will dissipate, that the fast intercourse, few words, and all-boy appetite will be replaced by the experienced sexuality the two of us shared before the cancer treatment. But it still isn't possible for him to ask for what he wants, or conduct a conversation, or remember the ways my body responds. And that's not even critical, because we're still in survival mode, trying to help him relearn his career and settle into the new house and help our children negotiate adulthood. Because Richard experiences both long-term and short-term memory loss, remembering sex is arduous, even when he is motivated to learn. The brain changes have made his desire immense. He artlessly reaches for me. His manned hands grasp my breasts before an exchange of words, glances, clenches. Even though I'm angry at what's happened to us, I cannot ignore his longing. I show him simple things, kissing, touching, the mechanics of moving the body. Flirting will come much later when he has grown a sense of self-awareness. I demonstrate affection, compliments, rapport, embraces, caresses, calls, catcalls, the French kiss. Every suggestion forgotten, every action forgotten. In order to adopt the behavior, he must be reminded, not dozens of times, thousands of times. I must learn to respond with compassion rather than anger. This one lesson, to deliver the sweetness that is now his favorite name for me, takes me 5 years to learn. 2,000 days. So whose brain is injured? Sex is paradoxically the most frustrating and the most meaningful way for me to learn how to detach from the desire for results. I'm constantly reminding myself, there's nowhere to go. This is it. But Richard seems to be able to focus on learning sex with all kinds of patience. How's it going, I ask him after an unsatisfying session. Being a good sex partner is challenging, right? I could please you before, most of the time. Yeah, but it isn't for lack of effort, he says, reporting. I know, baby. But you last more than a minute these days. That's good, right? I don't ask for more because you like to talk first, and I can't. Geez, it's like you hit the reset button on the whole aging thing. So what's the deal with doing the same motions over and over? Like when you used to stare at people without blinking. He reflects. I've learned enough of his process to be patient with the time it takes to for him to go from thinking to speaking. I'm only able to think of myself. I can't remember to think about what you feel at all. If we slow down, you'll get it. And we slow down every gesture, we stop and start again, we practice asking for what we want. For the first 5 years after the brain injury, he doesn't even think of seduction. To seduce means that you have to have available the skills of humor, teasing, tension, flirtation. But allurement isn't necessary for me anymore because I'm reacting in ways I could never have imagined. My body starts to respond differently than it ever has. My entire core heats up. I become a furnace. Even when my hands and feet are cool to the touch, I'm burning. My sexual appetite becomes ravenous. I covet every male between the ages of 16 and 66, and quite a few women, too. When my friend Judith calls to ask how it's going, I say, well, I didn't lick the barista today. I flirt with my male friends. I notice what men I am attracted to, what men I avoid. I gaze longingly at the surfer dudes and businessmen and construction workers. This is serious. My body is eroticizing itself at the exact time that I have been least sexually fulfilled. Some friends say it's a midlife crisis. Some say it's an expression of grief. A few spiritual friends say it's kundalini energy. I've heard of this energy expressing spontaneously in yogis and others who awakened, and I even experienced it in a meditation room years ago, a moment that manifested as a bodily tremor, an aspen in a mountain gust. But there's nothing enlightened about this feeling. I wonder if Richard's horny teenager mojo is contagious. Turning up the heat on my sexuality at the same time that he's more desirous and less adept is a strange brew. We're fleshly fools. I have what many women would enjoy, a new man, a fresh man, an unencumbered man. What I learned from teaching Richard about intimacy is that I only think him to be absent. His touch and gaze and presence are with me every time we are together. Our first year back in Seattle, Richard and I go on dates again. This has been our tradition, Saturday night out, just the two of us, which we have done since we found our way back to each other. In the past, we've had exquisitely simple dates, like the time we bought ice cream cones and sat by the river telling each other our dreams. And we've had outrageously fun dates at concerts, at the theater, on backpacking trips. Now, post-brain injury, our identity as the couple who can pull off these kinds of easy conversations is over. Richard prepares questions for each date so he has something to talk about. Without the preparation, conversation is impossible. One evening, we pick a fancy Tom Douglas restaurant and make reservations. I wear a beautiful dress and take time with my hair. I help him pick out a sweater and jeans. We sit in silence through most of the main course. He orders their famous donuts for dessert, and they come in a white paper bag, warm from the oven, ready to toss in the sugar. He spills their powder over the table. Then he licks his fingers and slides them across the sugar, licking, sliding, into the mouth. I glare at him. He's too shameless to notice. He isn't deliberately ignoring me. Part of what I'm learning is how the brain injured can be unresponsive to emotions. Weeks later, when my father nearly dies of a stroke and the doctors find a brain tumor, I sit on the stairs sobbing. I raise my hand. Dad had a stroke. They found a brain tumor. They don't know if he's going to recover. Oh, Richard responds. I know that I must change some of my ways to accommodate my new man's artlessness, and sometimes I fall short. At dinner, I grind my teeth and spit my words through a frozen jaw. If you lick your fingers in the restaurant, I'm not going out with you. In the wake of Richard's passivity, I have become assertive and in control. I manage our financial affairs, parental decisions, medical services, family relationships, and everything that was previously shared by the two of us. I'm one tenacious bitch, not unlike my paternal grandmother, Frances, who had 10 children and kept intact her marriage, family, and a large farm. But who I have become in Richard's silence surprises me. I'm increasingly uninterested in what others think. If a medical professional is unresponsive to our concerns, I fire that person and move Richard to another provider. I drive aggressively on the highways. I take my place. I learn to reject what isn't true. I leave friendships that aren't meaningful. I become more adept in examining my flaws, asking mentors and my children to help me see my shortcomings. I'm leaving behind a persona, the nice girl, who was, once upon a time, a useful inner chick who allowed me to slide unscathed past a raging father, offensive bosses, and misogynist teachers, all while looking pretty in pink. Once I was shy, compliant, and in the shadow of my tall, brilliant, authoritative husband. I remember a visit to a book festival long before the cancer arrived, an event that nearly cost us our marriage when Richard, despite my objections, confronted a respected author in front of an audience of a few hundred people on a subject Richard knew nothing about, contemporary poetry. I ran from that room ashamed and furious and straight to the therapist's office, where I spent months trying to get clear about the kind of woman I wanted to be, feminist and forgiving. Post-brain injury, Richard remembers nothing of the incident and sits silent in audiences and has not one thing in his nature that causes him to be combative or commanding. He's opinionless. Because Richard is an entirely new man, I realize that I don't have to bring our shared history to our experiment. I don't have to presume that I know anything about his satiation. In truth, what astounds me about my new man is that he doesn't have many preferences. What is the experience of pleasure when we are not habituated to a certain response? What do I have to learn from reconsidering my favorites and prejudices? As part of Richard having no preferences, he's not sure about his sexual identity. Does he like certain acts and not others? What kinds of sex make him feel pleasure? What are his limits? Is he attracted to both women and men? He likes women, he finds. Is he getting enough sex? Usually not. Tonight's date night subject is sex, I say. I'm on it. And later, over Pagliacci pizza and then at Cupcake Royale, the conversation continues. What kinds of experiences are sexual anyway? Why is intercourse considered sex and not punching down the yeasty dough of this pizza, I ask. What do people mean when they talk about sex, he says, really curious. What are your erotic desires, I volley back. I get to be with you, that you accept me as I am. And you? This is our marriage. We get to do it the way that we want. Soon after we arrive back in Seattle, our college graduate children uproot. Our son makes his home all the way across the country, and our daughter chooses to live in Europe. We stay where we are for a change and regard another new year, not from the perspective of mother and father, just as ourselves. We work, eat, and sit at home in silence. Silence that I'm not one bit grateful for. But it's the kind of silence that leads me to ask questions of myself. What are you? When did you begin? Where are you going? How do you define your values, beliefs, truths? In Richard, now years after the brain injury, I have a chance to observe someone who has no answers to these questions. He does not exist in memory, even to himself. He constantly forgets information, narrative, instructions, agreements, history, attachments, associations, requests, niceties, traditions, experiences. He doesn't always forget, and he doesn't never remember. He is habitual, and he is random. There is no method to understanding how the forgetting works. Even without a steady self, he has no issues related to lack of self-esteem. There is very little self to require esteem. When Richard begins to make his memories, I realize I'm constructing them through a collective rather than an individual reference, that the stories I'm telling him are an amalgamation of my memories and the ones he shared with me before the brain injury. When his mind begins to hold on to a story, he delights in telling his version of things to friends, colleagues, and his patients. As I listen to his tales, I can identify the elements that came from a variety of people. I can hear when a sentence comes from the recordings that Richard made with his sister and brother so his children would have their paternal history. The humorous ending to one of his stories comes from my attempt to make him laugh when I shared what he had done to amuse me, oh so long ago. He even picks up our language cues and voice pacing and punchlines. The collective recollecting becomes a way by which Richard remembers himself. His posture, ungainly and awkward following the surgery, becomes more conscious and graceful as he learns his story. His gaze softens and responds like a sensitive human's rather than a scared animal's. He isn't coming back, as people often like to say, that Richard no longer exists. But I see that Richard is building a container of a narrative to help him move about the world. And with these memories come fear, regret, and the desire for forgiveness. Richard isn't experiencing grief for a lost self. Grief pours only from us who knew him before. Richard sees himself as helpless to find that former being. He forgives his helplessness. He learns the stories because to form a history is to make us happy. He cares not for the worst or the best moments of his life. They are the same to him. I learn that the specific narrative does not matter. The genuineness of him, the presence of him as he is, what some people call awareness, is unadulterated. For the first time in my life, I begin to love someone for his essence, not for what he can offer me or reflect on to me or leave with me. It occurs to me that I might have watched my husband become himself, my desires for him notwithstanding. By waiting in the silence these circumstances have made for us, I've come to see him not as mine, but as something altogether curious and wonderful. Sometimes it's sweet, sometimes it's sexy, other times it's just damn hard work. In this way, as it turns out, ours is not much different from any other marriage. Thank you.